It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm your host, Lisa Keller. Allison Mariella Desir is an endurance athlete, activist, and mental health advocate, and authored the recently released book, Running While Black, Finding Freedom in a Sport That Wasn't Built for Us. Her book unveils the running movement as being centered around and represented by white people, not only ignoring the foundational work and performances of Black distance runners, but also not acknowledging that running while Black can be dangerous. Allison is the founder of Harlem Run, Run for All Women, and a founder and former co-chair of the Running Industry Diversity Coalition. She is the host and producer of Out and Back, a local public television program presented by KCTS9 in Seattle, Washington, that focuses on people of color in the outdoors. Allison will be in Anchorage for a book signing at Skinny Raven Sports on August 4th, and will lead a people of color running retreat through Run Alaska Trails in Moose Pass from August 6th to the 11th. Thanks for joining me today, Allison.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, it was really wonderful reading your book. I'm definitely recommending it to people because it's very powerful. And I think it's a really important book for runners to read, along with Running as My Therapy and Why We Run and all those other really important books about running. But also to people who maybe aren't running, because the message of running and maybe walking too is how important it is to human beings to be outside and doing activity.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, the book is obviously, you know, it's a running story, but it's bigger than that. It's about people who have felt like they don't belong in spaces, people who've ever felt excluded or powerless, and really just advocating for more space for all of us. We often operate from this zero-sum game, from this scarcity mindset, which is very American, to think that there's not enough and we have to hoard things, when truly we all deserve to be outside. We all deserve to be able to move our body and feel safe.
Can you tell us a little bit about how you came to running? Because there is another runner who's pretty famous in Alaska, and her name is Carol Sepelu. And I'm not sure if you've heard of her.
Yes, I have. She's indigenous, right?
Right.
Yes.
And I actually interviewed her a couple of years ago too. And you know, she, your story, when I was rereading it before we came on today, is sort of similar about how it started, how just so much despair, and just how for you, it was a friend who kind of lighted the candle, but for her, it was just like, she just managed to get herself out the door one day, but it was very similar. So tell us about your running origin story.
Yeah. You know, I hadn't actually thought about that, and I follow her on Instagram, and the running that she does is just incredible. But for me, so I was 10 years ago now, I was very depressed. I had been in a really bad relationship and really saw myself as existing only being worthwhile if this person loved me, right? And so the person obviously wasn't loving me appropriately, therefore I felt that I wasn't valuable. And then on top of that, my father was sick with Lewy body dementia, and he was already at the point where he was in diapers and he wasn't, you know, speaking English anymore. I couldn't find a job despite doing everything right, going to an Ivy League university and, you know, getting good grades. And so I started to feel really helpless and started to feel like, again, like I didn't matter and nobody would care whether I was around or not. So I spent a lot of my time just scrolling on social media. I was in bed, I was drinking and taking sleeping pills in hopes of just moving life along. And one day I saw this guy, a friend of mine who was training for a marathon on Facebook. And, you know, if you know anything about endurance athletes, is that we talk all about it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. People don't like coming to our parties if they don't run.
Exactly. I mean, it's got to be on Strava, on Facebook. It's got to be on all the things. But for whatever reason, seeing his messages started to light this fire in me of thinking that maybe I could do it if he could do it. Because he was Black, he was average build. He was not what I had seen reflected as the idea of a runner, right? Like I had typically thought of a long distance runner as being thin, white, male. And he was just this average looking Black guy who was sharing not just the physical transformation, but the mental transformation. And I kept following his journey, and I would reach out every now and then and ask him questions about like can you poop when you run? And
yeah,
what if you get hungry? You know, things that are valid questions if you're not in the endurance space. And he would answer. And a year later, I decided, well, you know, my life is going to continue as it is if I don't do something about it. Mm-hmm. And I signed up for my first marathon, and it just totally transformed my life. It saved my life, and it allowed me to see that there was hope for me, right? Like, mm-hmm. I didn't know about counseling really before then. I didn't know about the power of movement to help with your mental health. I didn't know just about the power of getting outdoors, how healing that could be. So that first marathon 10 years ago has started me on this trajectory to save and improve my life.
I just saw a study from, came through National Geographic on people being in green and blue spaces and how important that is. And actually they found that being in blue spaces next to the ocean, which maybe explains a lot of why most human beings live next to the ocean, is the highest, best way to improve mental health or to have good mental health. And then green space is next.
Absolutely. I think they call certain spaces, there's a special word for these particular parts in the world. I think there's like three or four parts of the world where they found that people live the longest and the healthiest lives. I forget what they call those parts, but all of those places have certain things in common, that there's green space, that there's blue space, that there's healthy food, that there's clean air, right? It's like, it's not a mystery.
Right,
what
exactly.
We need to thrive. It's just that it is not accessible or safe or available for everybody to access.
Right. And you were kind of living in a very urban area too, right? With a lot of like concrete and asphalt and big buildings.
Exactly. Yeah. I was in, at that point I was living in Fort Lee, New Jersey, which is right across the George Washington Bridge of New York. And I was doing all of my training in New York, and Fort Lee also is not like this lush green space, but even within that, just the beauty of Central Park. Harlem, New York has some of the most parks in New York, and recognizing that, you know, now I live on the West Coast and there's beauty everywhere, but within these concrete jungles, there are still spaces where you can find healing. And I think that's also what's really important. What I try to talk about in my book is that oftentimes the outdoors or adventure is portrayed as conquering and like summiting and doing the most epic, difficult thing. Really could just be going outside and walking down the street. Mm-hmm. If you have a backyard, sitting in your backyard, right? All forms of getting outside are beneficial.
Well, it's funny because I think you talked about, or maybe I might be confusing it, because then I went and watched the November Project video, and just the amount of work it takes on the East Coast to get to a place where your running group is. Like you have to maybe get on a bus. Maybe you're driving, but then you might take a subway, and that doesn't happen on the West Coast. You know, you can pretty much go out your door and be near a trail or something.
Yeah. You know, I've noticed, so I moved to Seattle 2.5 years ago, and the move was in the middle of the pandemic, which I know we're still in the pandemic, or maybe the government has decided we're not, but
yeah, yeah, right.
And we were, you know, in our apartment, which was like 600 square feet with our son, unable to go outside. We understood why, but we thought to ourselves, this is not the life that we want, right? Mm-hmm. And what a privilege it is to be able to say, this is not what we want. We're going to move somewhere else. So we came to Seattle. And so now I've been able to experience both the East Coast, West Coast. And on the East Coast, you're right. You know, people are getting on the train, seeking out places. And on the here, I mean, I live right across the street from a lake, right? So
yeah.
I go almost every day with my son to the lake. And I don't take that for granted. I still am pinching myself that I get to live like this.
Mm-hmm. I think we don't appreciate it. And have you been to Alaska before?
I have not. Alaska is a place that I said that just seemed like the end of the earth. I'm so thrilled that I'll be coming in just a few short weeks.
Yeah. It would be for you. It's like, Seattle on steroids. You know, I mean, we don't have a big city at all. We have a very small town, and it is literally the mountains are right there, you know? So, I think you'll love it. All the green space. And we live, you know, we live on inlet, which is very muddy, silty. So it's not really blue, but it's still this water, and there's a lot of water around Anchorage as well. So
beautiful.
So you did start with Team and Training, which is a lot of people's introduction to not just running, but triathlon too. So absolutely, it is a good way to get introduced to these sports. Yeah.
Totally. I think, you know, I'm so thankful for Team and Training because that is what got me on this trajectory. And, you know, when I thought about what it offered me this opportunity to try something new. It offered me just a new perspective on community and movement. But what it was lacking was racial diversity, right? I was showing up and I was one of the only people in those spaces who looked like me. And you know, the culture was one very white culture. And so I felt while it was saving me and it was giving me so much, I also felt like, well, this is not a place where I can really be myself, which is ultimately why after running my first marathon and raising $5,000 for the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society, I decided, well, I'm going to start my own space, right? I'm going to take all of the wonderful things I experienced in Team and Training, but center Black people in this experience, put it in a mostly Black neighborhood, partner with other Black and Brown organizations, and make sure that people feel like they can show up as their authentic selves.
And that was Harlem Runs that you started. Yeah. Yep. So one thing I do think I remember and pulling out of my head, so maybe you can correct me if I'm wrong, is that actually Black people are more affected by leukemia and lymphoma. They do. Is it at a higher rate, or just survival rates aren't as good?
You know, I actually don't know, but I would not be surprised. I do talk about health disparities in my book. I don't address that specifically, but I wouldn't be surprised if the health outcomes are worse because the access to medicine and access to resources is worse. And also, if you think about just the history of medical treatment in this country, there's a great book called Medical Apartheid, and it talks about the ways in which Black people and Puerto Ricans and immigrants have been used as test subjects, right? So if we've been given syphilis, if we've been sterilized, then we're not as eager to go trust our healthcare professionals, right? So there's a question of access, but then there's also a question of, do we want, we're not, and you know, we saw this a lot with the COVID.
Yes.
Right.
And yeah, absolutely.
There was resistance, of course, from the far right for, you know, ludicrous reasons, but then there was resistance from a lot of marginalized communities because there has been so much, distrust built in this country around medicine and, disadvantaged people that of course you would doubt the intentions of a vaccine.
And then you also, like, Black women have such a higher rate of pregnancy complications and birth complications, and you also experienced that, and also pointing out the Serena Williams, who's like somebody who has a lot of money and resources, almost died.
Exactly. And, you know, I can't tell you how many women, Black women I know, who have given birth between 24 weeks and 32 weeks, right? It's just a mix of factors, from preeclampsia, from again, the medical professionals looking at Black women and not believing our pain, not believing what we're saying, what we're feeling, right? Dismissing us, which therefore leads to further complications. But yeah, I'm actually at a point now in my life where I'm considering whether I want to have another child. And I just wonder if I'm being greedy, right? Like, if I made it, I survived the first pregnancy, what if I attempt to have another one and I die and then I'm not there for my son, right? And I know that that's not the same kind of logic that white women have when they're thinking about another child.
No, I had problems with my first child. That didn't occur to me with my second child at all.
Yep.
You're right. Okay. So that kind of also brings us into the book, and really what is so important about the book is the current state of the running scene in the United States is that it is built for white people or is built around white people. And there isn't this space. And I found this section amazing, having been a runner my whole life, and then also learning about the pioneers of running, which I had no idea, and I'm very embarrassed that I didn't know these things, you know. So it was a really great history lesson too of the true start of the running scene in the United States. So let's go to the boom, the running boom in the 60s and 70s. And also, I'll also tell you, I went to University of Oregon in Eugene.
No way!
Yes. So it was pretty powerful reading that. But also, I do have to tell you, you know, I went to college the fall of 1982 was when I entered Eugene. And coming from Anchorage, which at the time was fairly diverse, our diversity, the power of our diversity, I think, is that we don't have like Black native neighborhoods,
right,
Latinx neighborhoods. Everybody's mixed up. It's more of a socioeconomic thing. And I went to East High School, which is right now the most diverse high school in the United States. And both my daughters went there as well. So Anchorage actually has three of the most diverse high schools in the United States. And then we have the most diverse
reading about it. Yeah.
Voting precinct or voting district in the United States. So we were pretty diverse back in the 80s, but nothing like it is now. I mean, So I went to Oregon, and when I got there, I was drawn there. I played soccer there, but I was drawn there because of running, because I'd been a runner my whole life. And I was used to a very diverse, I was on track. That was my favorite sport. Even cross country running was a little bit diverse, but I walked onto that campus, and the first thing I noticed is there are no Black people here. None. And there weren't at that time, no Asian people. I mean, it was lily white. And that was a big shocker for me, coming from a place where I had much more interaction with people of color. And to go there and see, wow, there are places that are just white, and that's where running started.
Yes.
And that's not where it started, but
right.
That's our story.
That's where the story starts. I mean, and I think what a unique perspective you have, because there, in my experience, I have met very few white people who ever notice that a place is white. White has been normed and has been seen as the default, white people, I mean, that's white privilege, right? But
right.
Take it for granted that they're always going to be the majority. They're always going to be shown in a positive light. But to your point, you know, I love history. And what I love most about history is that it's sort of like a detective story.
Right? Yeah.
And you learn one thing in school, particularly now with book bans and the government dictating what stories can be told and what has to be removed for white people's sake. Mm-hmm. You're just getting one side of the story told from people in power, right? Mm-hmm. So what I love about history is being able to go back and get the truth, right? So as I started training for that first marathon, I kept hearing the name Prefontaine. And I say this in the book, I thought that the person was first name Pre, last name Fontaine. Prefontaine, he's just one word. Come to find out he's Steve Prefontaine. So I got curious about that. And I started Googling the running boom and the origins of running. And of course, then you come up with the story of Bill Bowerman and him inviting people to Hayward Field. And so I got curious, well, what were these first 2000 men, women, and children? What did they look like? The people who joined Bill Bowerman and Hayward Field. And in the images from the newspapers, they're all white people, right? And I started to think, well, that was 1963. What was going on with Black people in 1963? And I was like, of course, it was the civil rights movement. Black people couldn't even walk through the front door of a building. Black and white people couldn't get married, right? Like Martin Luther King was giving his I Have a Dream speech. So it started to put into context. On the one hand, you have the so-called running boom, which is calling white people to get outside and to move their bodies. And on the other hand, you have the United States, which is restricting Black people from living full lives, right? Mm-hmm. From moving through any kind of space. And that to me was why I start the book with this timeline of what I call, you know, running history, and on the other side, Black people's reality. Another stark event for me was 1896, which again, because I'm like a history nerd, these dates stick out to me. And I knew that was the year of the first modern Olympics, but I also knew that was the year of the Plessy versus Ferguson case, which literally institutionalized racism, right? Like that is what led to segregation and the idea that separate could be equal. So I started to think about this, and it allowed me to look at the running boom with new eyes. And on top of all of this, right, what we don't get is that 30 years prior in Harlem, the Pioneer Club was really setting the stage for the modern running movement, that it was, you know, these two Black men in Harlem, Yancey and I think Douglas, I can't remember the names right now, but they were starting this organization that was for all people, which back then meant men, but yeah. For Jewish people and Black people and Puerto Rican people to all run together. This idea that running was not just for fast people, which in the 1940s was revolutionary. Mm-hmm. And it was the first, one of the first organizations to have, like, it was integrated before even Jackie Robinson integrated baseball, right? Mm-hmm. So if we want to talk about what led to running taking off, what was happening in Harlem. It was this movement about movement. It was rooted in civil rights ideas and the idea that everybody should be able to show up and move their body in an authentic way.
Yeah, that's just like hitting me so hard listening to you say it. I mean, I've read it in the book too, but listening to you say it, because I'm also have all these thoughts of going through my head at that time, you know, yes, this connection between actually being able to move anywhere you want and running. And exactly. White people totally take that for granted, maybe women to a lesser extent, because right. There are dangerous places for women. Right. But as a whole, we take that for granted. Like, we can run through any neighborhood or any place and, you know, but and at that time, if you could get killed.
Exactly. So,
and even now, obviously, right. You can get killed.
And you know, the thing that also, like, again, often I don't know everything, but I'm very interested in history. And so, for example, you think about the ways that just the recent scenarios of Black people doing ordinary things and being killed, like Ahmaud mm-hmm. Arbery or yes. Bird watching, right? At any point, a white person can call on the police and the police will be in their support, because the police mm-hmm. was actually developed as a force to capture runaway slaves, right?
Right. So yeah.
Many people don't know that. Many people don't understand what we say when we're talking about, like, the whole institution of policing needs to be abandoned and reconfigured mm-hmm. because it's right. rooted in controlling Black bodies and how yep. we move through space, right? And mm-hmm. and that's the thing, like, you know, I don't always feel a sense of mortal danger, but I do. Even I mentioned that I live across the street from a park or from a lake. When we go to the lake as a family and we're the only Black people, it's like, okay, if something goes down, well, we better be the first out of here, because mm-hmm. either we're gonna be accused of something or we're gonna face the consequences, right? And white people just don't have to have that sort of, like, meta thought of you're living something, but then you're also thinking about how other people are thinking about you experiencing that thing.
I think what was really powerful too was the example you used in your book. I think I know the group it is, but where you go to this group and yes, exactly. And they're bouncing up and down and they're yelling things back and forth to each other
at the mayor's house.
Next to the mayor's house. And, like, could a group of Black people do that? No, there's no way a group of Black people. I mean, the police would be there so fast. It's exactly. just, and that was a pretty, when I read that example, I'm like, oh my gosh, like, yeah, these things you don't even see, you know, until you have, you know, until you listen to the people who are there experiencing it. That's right. What you got to do, you know?
Right. And these things happen, you know, my book again focuses on the running experience, but that is true in so many cases when there's a protest, right? And Black people are protesting and if property gets damaged, then, you know, people get really upset. But when, like, a football team wins a game and you see white people shifting cars and flipping them upside down and burning things, there's no conversation about hoodlums or
right.
the importance of property, right? There's different standards. And that seeps its way into running, right? Like, nothing mm-hmm. in this world, a world that is rooted in white supremacy and sexism and homophobia and transphobia, that means everything we create in this world is within that context, right? And that's really what I wanted to show, that I love running so much, but I'm writing this book because we have to be aware of the ways that running is, you know, all of that has trickled into the sport that we love. Mm-hmm. And we have a real opportunity to do something about it.
You say this throughout the book too, that the slogan "running is for everyone" is used quite often, but there's really not a lot backing that up, both for people of color. And I would also say heavier people. I mean, that's a big thing, or disabled people.
Yep.
There doesn't seem to be a welcoming environment in many, many running groups to people that are not what we typically think of as a runner.
Definitely. And, you know, a good, a friend of mine, Martinez, now I can't remember his last name, Evans, I believe, just came out with a book, Slow AF Run Club, or Slow AF Guide. The name of his run club is Run Slow AF, which is, I won't say it, but you all know what I'm saying.
Yep.
And he's somebody in a larger body. He's over close to 300 pounds. And there are very little spaces when he's running down the street, it's a spectacle, right? Because people aren't expecting to see him. People look at him and therefore assume he must be a beginner. He's also Black, I should say,
right?
Because he's running slowly, he must be a beginner. So people offer him advice all the time, right? And it's no, bigger bodies run, you know, and that's not, we don't get to comment on it just because we feel some type of way, right?
Yeah, exactly.
With women, like, just because I wear something that you find to be provocative, I'm not wearing it for you. I'm wearing it for me, you know?
Exactly. The other thing that this was also, cause, the story about, oh gosh, what race was it? Was it the 5,000 or it was the one? Now, see, this is terrible right now because I'm not remembering the woman's name who won the race, a Black woman.
Alicia Montano, and it was the 800 meters.
It was the 800 meters. Okay. Yeah. And, but Molly Seidel.
Oh, you're okay. No, you're talking about, this was the marathon. This was the Olympic marathon, and was Molly Seidel and Alafin Tuliamuk. And Alafin,
this was the trials, right?
It was the Olympic trials.
The 2020 Olympic trials.
Okay. 2020 Olympic trials. Yeah. So I attended the 2020 Olympic trials, and going into the race, there was so much excitement around Alafin, or at least I felt a whole lot of excitement around Alafin. Mm-hmm. I was cheering on the sidelines. And then I remember, like, I would go from cheering out on the sidelines to go inside and watch on the screen. And just that what I was seeing was not matching up with what the commentary was, right? Like the commentary was focused on Molly, who Molly is incredible. She also has a powerful story, but Molly wasn't winning, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then after Alafin won the Olympic trials, all of the stories were about Molly being the underdog and how impressive she was. And Alafin was hardly mentioned. When she was mentioned in this exotic context, talking about how many siblings she has, or, you know, things that unrelated to her talent. And this, I mentioned Alicia Montano and the 800 meters because she also had a similar experience when she was racing, and she would be the person to beat in a race, but the second and third place white women would be talked about, right? Mm-hmm. And this is the way that implicit bias shows up, right? I don't necessarily believe that it's the intention of these race announcers to be racist, right? Mm-hmm. But the effect is that you take away the moment from these women, right? Like, their names being said, the press that they get, all of that actually directly impacts their sponsorship agreements, right? Mm-hmm. Like being on covers of magazines, that allows you to get sponsorship bumps. So all of this is connected, and we must hold the media responsible for equity in their coverage.
And I think that's also important in terms of, like, these women are examples to other Black women. Like, other Black women see them and say, hey, they're doing this, I can do that, you know, and it increases participation as white women have and Black women, actually, to a lesser degree, because I've done a lot of work, history work on Title IX. Mm-hmm. But just seeing more women in sports gets more girls out playing sports.
Absolutely.
It's very important to see yourself represented, you know, whoever you are. And we have a diverse nation, and running should represent that.
Exactly. Absolutely.
You are listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Lisa Keller. We are going to take a short break, and when we return, we'll hear more from Allison Mariella Desir, author of Running While Black, Finding Freedom in a Sport That Wasn't Built for Us.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. Find the show anytime as a free podcast in the iTunes Store or connect with us online at alaskapublic.org.
You are listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Lisa Keller. My conversation with Allison Mariella Desir, author of Running While Black, Finding Freedom in a Sport That Wasn't Built for Us, continues. Let's talk about Harlem Runs. Mm. So how did you get that going and the impact it's had? Because it's quite well known. I mean, I knew about it before I read your book. So,
10 years ago, almost exactly, I started Harlem Run after going through that first marathon experience. At the time, it was called Powdered Feet Run Club after my nickname. My nickname Powdered Feet came from my father, who is, he was from Haiti. And it's a Haitian Creole saying for somebody who's so active, you don't see them, just the footprints of where they've been in powder. And it's because I was all over the place doing everything, a lot like my son today. But I called it Powdered Feet Run Club and decided I was going to meet every Monday night in front of this yoga studio, and started in November. And I was hopeful that people would show up. Nobody showed up for like 3 to 6 months. Oh. One of the very early people to show up was my now husband, who I could not stand at the time. But what I noticed in him, and I do have to give myself credit, I think I do a really good job of two things: making people feel comfortable and excited, and recognizing leadership. So I saw in him that he was committed to this idea of a place where people could move freely and enjoy themselves. And we decided to join forces. And we joined forces, we changed the name to Harlem Run. And I would say within a year after that, there were over 100 people who were joining us. Mm-hmm. And it just, I still think about those days, and it was like a movie. Like, you just never knew who was going to show up, how many people were going to show up. It was like the place to be on a Monday night. And out of that group, I've made so many friends. I've seen people get out of really bad relationships. I've seen people get into new relationships. I've seen people change jobs, lose weight, change their health outcomes, right? Like, Harlem Run has really been the site of yes, this like physical transformation, but just this community that has had a really big impact, and not least of which is raising lots and lots of money for different organizations.
And it's free? People can just show up? Is there dues or anything like that?
It's free. So we meet every Monday. I say we, I'm no longer in Harlem.
Questions. Yeah. It's running without you now.
Yeah, that's a beautiful thing. I think as a community leader, one of the things that you hope is that the group continues when you're gone. So right. I'm still engaged with the leadership team, but I'm not there. So the group meets every Monday. It meets every second and fourth Thursday, and every Tuesday morning. We have a online app that we use that allows people to organize, which has been really cool. People are not meeting because of who the leaders are or because somebody is cool or somebody, right? People are meeting because they enjoy each other's company. And in that space, that halo space, people can choose to donate if they want to. Mm-hmm. But it's always been important to me that it's free. And I think actually, if this were something that I were paid for or that the leadership team were paid for, we probably wouldn't invest as much, which, right? It's like capitalism says that you should be paid for your work and that's how you feel good.
Right.
But that's just untrue, right? I mean, don't get me wrong. I do get compensated for my work, but the way that we give when it's because we love to do it and because we know the impact is far more than any dollar amount could compel me to do it, you know?
Well, I think so. I'm a professional coach, and but I think your Harlem Run came out of a different aspect, more of like, you know, we just want to get people involved, and we want people to see people who look like them and everything, than like my business. So I definitely want to continue to still be paid too. So
right. No, and that's the thing where I make a clear distinction, right? Because sometimes people come to Harlem Run and then they get really excited and have specific goals. And I say to them, what you need is a coach. And we have many coaches within Harlem Run, and coaches absolutely deserve to be paid. But that's not what we're doing. The two coexist.
Yes.
But a coach, that's a profession, you know? Mm-hmm. And this is, while theoretically, you know, we could get paid also in this community, it's more about building bonds and, you know, creating space for us.
Well, I also like that it's outside of capitalism too, because we need more space like that too. So,
yes.
So talk also a little bit about Ted Corbett, because he is just amazing. And also, we want to also talk about Marilyn Bevins.
Yes.
And because I think they're both stories that for certain white runners do not know these stories.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you're listening, raise your hand if you know who Ted Corbett is.
Yeah, exactly.
Few hands went up.
Yeah.
So Ted Corbett was one of the most well-known members of Pioneer Run Club. Pioneer Run Club was started in Harlem, New York, by Joseph Yancey and this other gentleman whose name I forgot. And Ted Corbett was just an incredible runner. He would run. He's a black guy. He was a black man, obviously. Yeah. He would run 20 miles to work, 20 miles home. He was a physical therapist. He was actually the person responsible for standardizing race distances. You know, before Ted Corbett, a marathon could be 26.4 miles, could be a little under. He standardized the race distance. He was the first black man to compete in the Olympic marathon in 1956 in Helsinki. He's actually the person who created the idea for the New York City Marathon, running in the five boroughs. And right now, if you Google that, to this day, a white man is given credit for that. Mm-hmm. But
that white man, he even said, no, Ted Corbett gave me the idea.
Exactly. but Ted Corbett, you know, the New York City Marathon existed, but at that time, it only ran through Central Park. And Ted Corbett had the idea of doing something special for the centennial and expanding it beyond the park. And as I was doing this research, Ted Corbett's son is Gary Corbett, who is a running historian, does not get enough credit for just what he is bringing to the sport. He has saved typewritten letters from his father to this other gentleman about the origin story of the New York City Marathon. And yet and still, a white person gets credit for it.
Mm-hmm.
But Ted Corbett was he really is the grandfather of long distance running. Mm-hmm. And then Marilyn Bevins is a black woman who grew up running before Title IX and would run with the boys and just was an exceptional marathon runner. She often in marathon races, you know, it would be Catherine Switzer first and Marilyn Bevins second. And while many of us probably know the name Catherine Switzer, very few people know the name Marilyn Bevins. And what Catherine Switzer did for white women is what Marilyn Bevins did for black women. Mm-hmm. And I know that not many people talk about Catherine Switzer in that way, right? They say Catherine Switzer did this for women. But when you actually look at the impact, it was white women who were most impacted by Switzer, right? Because as a black woman, you're not just facing sexism, you're facing anti-blackness as well.
Right. Yeah. I like that too, that you point out even in the running world, the intersectionality of all of these things. And that, I think it was when you were, working the Running Industry Diversity Coalition.
Yes, yes. So my life has taken all these twists and turns. And when I tell you that growing up, I never knew what I wanted to be when I grew up. And I think that was a good thing because I left it open for just all these possibilities. But so after, let me back up a little bit. In the pandemic, also when I was living, when we were living in the Bronx in this very small apartment, Ahmaud Arbery was murdered. And my son at the time was just 10 months old. And it hit me really hard because of that, right? Like certainly I grew up always hearing about Black people killed by police or vigilantes and knowing that the justice system does not offer justice for us. But having a Black son and thinking to myself, oh my God, in 25 years, somebody could just kill him mm-hmm. and get away with it. So I wrote this op-ed that was published in Outside Magazine and it went viral. And Black people and other marginalized people were thanking me for putting this into words, right? The idea that running is both freeing, but also comes with an increased set of risks being a Black person in this country. And white people were shocked and had never considered the experience of anyone other than themselves. Mm-hmm. So I thought yep. to myself, okay, I want to write a book about this. And so that's where the idea for Running While Black began. And at the same time, I was approached by three white people. They were, each of them were in the running retail side, so running stores, who were affected by the murder of Ahmaud Arbery and all the other murders that were happening during that time of Black people doing ordinary things. Mm-hmm. And they said, well, we want to do something about this. And so they came to me along with a few other activists. And my first response was, well, okay, what do you want to do? And they admitted that they knew nothing about racial equity. They didn't know where to start, but they wanted to do something. And I remember thinking at the time just how misguided these people were, right? Like, if you know nothing about this subject, then why do you think you're the one who should do something about it, right?
Right, and yeah.
Why should I volunteer my time to help you figure it out? So there was a lot of contention at first around, well, what can the running industry do? Like right now, the running industry, at that point, the running industry, nobody ever talked about race outside of, well, I should say no white people ever talked about race. And white people in the industry thought that running really was for everybody. But running retailers, running brands, running events, anybody who was actually making money within the running industry and held power was mostly white, right? Mm-hmm. So anyway, so we came to this consensus that we wanted to start a coalition that would include all these different types of people, and we would set standards around racial equity and hold the industry accountable. And that was the start of the Running Industry Diversity Coalition. I was a co-founder of it and a co-chair. I've since stepped away from the organization, but it is, you know, it's making a deep impact and facing a lot of resistance. Mm-hmm. One of the first things that we wanted to do was a research study to find out, well, just how white is this industry, right? We know that the power is concentrated in lots of white people's hands, but we put out surveys to all of these different organizations and brands and companies to get their racial equity data. And very few companies wanted to participate because mm-hmm. they were afraid of how the transparency would make them look. Right? They didn't want people to truly have the data showing just how poorly they were doing.
Right.
So here is where a company might have a good intention, but isn't actually going to follow it up with action because they're prioritizing how they look. Mm-hmm. And that is a lot of the struggle in doing this work. Nobody wants to look bad. Nobody wants to feel bad. And so they center their own feelings instead of, well, racism is the actual bad thing here, right? Racism is hurting people, not right. you and your feelings.
Yeah. You even had an example in there where at some point you guys were almost like at the point of getting everything cleaned up. And then somebody came back and said, our lawyers say we might be sued if we're admitting that we're not doing a good job at this point.
And again, it speaks to just like the litigious nature of the United States, which I don't want to downplay, right? Everybody does right. sue for everything, but we're talking about racial equity work. And so mm-hmm. what happened was, when you read my book, you hear this story, but we created this sort of like manifesto, our values. And in it, we said that the running industry was rooted in white supremacy, that, you know, as much as the running industry has done a lot of good for a lot of people, it has not advocated for Black and brown people, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And so we had finally decided on the language. Then we sleep on it and somebody comes back and says, well, using white supremacy, that's not joining language. We might be alienating people. We get on the same page. Then we come back. Oh, but a lawyer might say that if we admit that we've been rooted in white supremacy, that means that we've been racist and then we could be sued, right? So just all of the ways that white people's fears were getting in the way of just a statement, right? Mm-hmm. We hadn't even done any work. We were just putting a statement about what the issues were. And, thankfully we moved beyond that, but I think it's really important. That's a really important part of the book because this is happening mm-hmm. everywhere all the time. Like there are still people sitting there asking themselves, how do we start? And how do we do it without making us look bad? Right. And that is missing the point.
Do you think that the group is, because this happened started like 2 or 3 years ago, right?
2020, yeah.
Yeah. So do you think at this point they're doing a better job? They're actually making concrete steps, not just words, but actual concrete steps to improving?
Absolutely. I think a lot of it has to do with just building trust and relationships within the board, mm-hmm. which is true just in general, right? In order for racial equity work to happen, there needs to be a sense of trust and accountability. And it needs to be a space where, like, yes, you are going to say and do the wrong thing, and that is okay. We're going to move on and we're going to keep going. Right. So I think the board is absolutely doing the work. I think it's just the resistance that they're facing. Yeah. The good, nice, well-meaning people who don't want to be transparent, who mm-hmm. don't want to be accountable for fear of what that might mean.
Are they putting out anything like, okay, we're going to strive to, you know, have like, and actually this is very relevant right now with the recent Supreme Court ruling on affirmative action in colleges that may actually be changing the way companies are going to have to operate as well now. Yeah. But are they making any goals, like percentage goals, like, okay, let's go for trying to get 20% of our salespeople, which to me is low in some parts of the country, at least, but 20% of our salespeople should be people of color. Are they making moves like that?
Absolutely. So the goal for the Running Industry Diversity Coalition is that both runners, running participants, and people in the industry, so people who make money from this sport, reflect national demographics. Mm-hmm. So national demographics are now, I think white people make up like a little less than 60% mm-hmm. and people of color make up 40. And those demographics are shifting. By 2045, white people will no longer be the majority. So that is our hope, that the running industry, I mean, truly all industries should be reflective of the demographics of the national population. The fact that it is so disproportionate is evidence that it's not just about talent. Right. And to your point, you know, with the Supreme Court ruling, I do think that jobs are absolutely going to use that as a loophole mm-hmm. to say that we're going to go back to meritocracy, as if, you know, affirmative action was about correcting historical wrongs, but also for people who were merited, right? Who deserved
absolutely it. Who weren't getting chances. Yeah.
I will say that the one caveat for me, and I haven't looked into it, is that apparently the state of Washington has not been, was never paying attention, or since the 80s stopped using affirmative action in private institutions. Mm-hmm. And again, I just saw this news somewhere and I didn't look into it, so I'm not sure what it means, but I am curious. What has Washington State been doing then for the past 40 years?
Yeah.
How were they not, using affirmative action, and what were the outcomes? I don't know. So that's sort of like a question mark for all of us to do some research, but, and maybe I misread the article title, but I'm curious.
So being in the Seattle area now, and obviously there's a lot of white people there and that has to be a big shift coming from the East Coast.
Totally.
But what has been your experience so far?
Yeah, it's funny. Like in the mornings, we used to hear sirens. And now where I live, because I live north of Seattle, we hear turkeys in the morning.
Yeah. Oh, that's great.
Like, what? I mean, turkeys are less intense than sirens, but it's disarming.
So maybe it's the difference of moving from just a plain urban environment. Like if you lived in downtown Seattle, would be different than where you're living now.
Totally. Absolutely. And you know, when we first moved to Seattle, again, it was January of 2021. So still very high pandemic restrictions. But I remember we were living in downtown Seattle and I was like, they call this a city? Like it just like a little like pretend place compared to the density and intensity of New York. But now we live more in the suburbs. And what I'll say is that living in New York, I never had to be intentional about finding my people. Like Black and brown people were everywhere. Like there were so many different kinds of Black and brown people that you would find them. Here, if I hadn't been intentional about like showing up at different groups, also I have this PBS show that is focused on Black Indigenous people of color in the outdoors. I came up with that show idea, and part of that was helping me to find my people. So it's taken a lot of work, and I know other Black people who live here who haven't done that work and therefore don't have as big of a network as I do. But yeah, I just made sure that I was showing up places, reaching out to people, because I didn't want to feel a sense of isolation.
Mm-hmm. Are there Black running groups in that area?
Yeah, there's a Black Girls Run. There's a Black Men Run. A friend of mine who's a Black woman started a running crew that's north of Seattle that I go to regularly. There's a Run CSRD is this group that's in Seattle. I mean, there are, I'm not going to say a lot, but there's enough here, right? You can find your community, but if you're not looking for it, you won't.
But that has to be exhausting to have to find your community. I don't have to go find my community.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. No, it is. It's additional work. And again, part of my PBS show that I love to just tell people stories and get to try different things in the outdoors, but it has been such a resource that I know that teachers are using in their classrooms to show students, like, look at all the things you can do. Look at all the different racially diverse groups there are. Mm-hmm. I know that it's helped. This one man told me he's been living in Seattle. He's in his 50s and he's been living in Seattle forever. And one of the episodes I do is with this Black fly fisherman. And this gentleman told me, I watched that show and I never knew there were other Black fly fishermen here.
Oh, wow.
I was like, well, there's at least one. Go find Giancarlo, right? So it's definitely become a resource. And I'm glad, you know, I'm glad to be able to be that person. I wish that we could just enter spaces and we're everywhere. It's work that I'm happy to do.
Yeah. Well, we're glad you're on the West Coast now. So we're glad to have you.
Thank you. So
let's talk about you coming up to Alaska and Run Alaska Trails has retreats for runners, and your retreat is a person of color retreat in Moose Pass. So what's going to happen during your retreat?
Yeah, well, first I have to say how this all came about is that Kim, who owns Run Alaska Trails, reached out to me via my website, and I have this little contact form. And I have to tell you that I get so many amazing opportunities through that contact form. So if anybody's thinking about creating their own website, do it. So I get this email and it says like, I'm Kim, this is my tour company. Would you want to take a group of people to Alaska? And at first I was like, this is bananas. Like to me was, again, the end of the earth.
Yeah.
I was like, and who is this woman? But she listed the names of other people who she had worked with, who I knew. I had a conversation with her and she was like, look, I have this tour logistics company. I like to partner with leaders and community-minded folks who bring their people to Alaska. Is this of interest? Mm-hmm. And I said, absolutely. Like, I would love to go to Alaska and I would love to bring people like me on the trip. So that's exactly what's happening.
Oh, awesome.
For people of all genders who are Black, Indigenous, people of color. And so we're going to do all of the amazing outdoor stuff. We're going to go on glaciers and we're going to, run the trails and we're going to be on this beautiful lake. And also what's important to me is to tell this history of Black people in Alaska, right?
Yes.
I certainly didn't think Black people were in Alaska. Come to find out that there, to your point, there's actually, we not only did we help build a lot of the infrastructure there, mm-hmm. but we've contributed so much to the culture. Mm-hmm. There was an exhibit at the Anchorage Museum that was based on this book that I think is called Black in Alaska that I've been reading. And then of course, just the Indigenous and Alaska Native, mm-hmm. right? Like, but we don't, those stories aren't told. So in right. addition to this trip being about joy in the outdoors, it's also gonna share all of the ways that we have existed in the outdoors forever.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, we belong there.
Yes. Oh, that is so exciting. And so you're bringing people with you, and are there spaces left in the retreat?
Yeah, there are a few spaces. Good. You know, it's a trip that I would say it's not inexpensive, but it's yeah. actually a really great deal for all of the things that we're going to do. So if you happen, maybe you're local to Alaska and want to go on this trip, or you've just got the money, there are a few spots left. There are about 15 of us right now, and people are coming from all over the country, right? Mm-hmm. And this is the kind of trip, even if you're coming from Washington, which is closer to Alaska, it is the kind of trip that's like a bucket list trip.
Right.
Right? Mm-hmm. Like, so people are really excited, and I hope that this is the first of many trips to Alaska for me.
Oh, that's awesome. I did actually have coffee with a friend on Wednesday, and I was telling her I was interviewing you, and she said she's Latinx, and she's like, I want to sign up for that. So yes! she was gonna look it up and see if she could make it work.
There's room. Come on in.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Allison, it's just been a joy talking to you. I've really enjoyed it. Mm-hmm. And also, I didn't get a chance to see your PBS show yet. Now I'm going to go watch that. And so I will probably get some ideas from that. And I might have to revisit you at some point too, in regards to that.
I am here for it. It's called Out and Back. So awesome. Take a look.
Great. Thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you. I really appreciate it. And to everyone listening, I can't wait to explore the, what do you call Alaska? You refer to us as the lower 48.
Or outside with a big O. You're outside with a big O.
Can't wait to see you outside.
Yep. That's it for today's show. Thanks to my guest, Allison Mariella Dazier. Allison will be at Skinny Raven Sports on Friday, August 4th, starting at 6 p.m. with a community run, followed by a reading from her book, a conversation with the audience, and a book signing. From August 6th to the 11th, she will be leading a People of Color running retreat in Moose Pass through Run Alaska Trails. You can find pictures and links to all of Allison's organizations and projects on the Outdoor Explorer page on alaskapublic.org. The show is produced by Eric Bork. My name is Lisa Keller, and from all of our hosts here at Outdoor Explorer, thanks for listening, and we'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal, The Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and in your favorite podcast app. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.